Now it's my pleasure to introduce Ian Powell, who's our speaker this evening, I think you'll enjoy listening to what he has to say, but come on, let's get up here because we've got to find out why he likes wine and good food.
Because
I think that's pretty important, isn't it, Ian?
It is very important. As a young man, I liked quantities of food, and I began to appreciate food really through two friends, Jim Bates, who was a psychologist I met at a church, and I'd go and have dinner. Our family would go and have dinner, and he just cooked the most amazing food. And so what I would do is I would get the recipe and cook it for the family. And so I've got about three things I can cook really well, and one is called Jim's. So I often say to the girls when it's coming out to their birthday, what would you like to do? Go to a restaurant or any meal of your choosing, and they say, we want Jim Bates's prawn dish. So that was good. And the other one was a lady, Amel Halou, who's a Lebanese lady, and it was at her place with another group of people from our church that I discovered that my conclusion is, as a man of almost no knowledge, that Lebanese food is the best in the world, I think. So capers was great to have something more Middle Eastern. Yeah. Apart from the cute name, can there be anything cuter than a thing called a caper? I think that's just a great... I love that name.
Right, that's good. Well, you better tell us a little bit about yourself, I think, and because I think people would like to know a little bit about you.
Well, you know, I'm a redneck from Sydney, really. I lived all my life in the one little valley and get out as often as I can. I tried to get out of Sydney often, but it hasn't worked. But this is as good as it gets, really, getting to come to Adelaide every few months, which has been fun.
Mm, good. That's good.
Yep. So, sorry. Now, Ian, I've heard that you had a bowl of rice a day for a whole week.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think I could do that.
No, neither did I. Look, it was a silly idea, really, and I was surprised that I got through it. I realised that there was this whole famine thing happening in the, I think it's called the Horn of Africa, and I'd been hearing about it, and I realised there was suddenly a moment where I thought, gosh, this is real, and I'm not doing anything. You just get used to hearing bad story after bad. So out of nowhere, I don't know if I should blame it on God or not, I just thought I should, because I've never done anything like this, I should go for a week on 2 cups of rice a day plus salt, for 5 days, and encourage people to give towards it on a rising scale. Because I thought there was very little likelihood I'd get through the 5 days. I'm not the world's most disciplined man, as you can probably see. But I got a surprising amount of support, and others did some stuff. I did get through the 5 days, and quite a few $1,000 was raised, much more than I thought. But on the last day, I was in Geelong, and I only ate half the rice because I had a visceral hatred of rice after. And I should have, just with salt, I should have had pepper or something like that. And so I only ate half the amount because I hated eating rice. I hated the taste. I've recovered. But the meal at the end, we waited for midnight, when I could finally eat again. And I had one of the loveliest meals I've ever eaten. It was 2 bits of raisin toast with butter and a banana and a glass of port. and the sort of appreciation you have when you can... The textures and the smell. And it was one of the loveliest... And I'm not planning on doing it again. But
okay. I better remember the port and banana. That sounds like something we can build on.
Yeah, I can smell a bit of banana. No?
Now, tonight we're in for a treat. I've heard Ian only talk once and about a topic that I thought was quite appropriate for me, the prodigal son. But you're talking about the banquet and food in general, I look forward to it.
Thank you very much. Now, if you're... You know, they talk about companies and people going to the wall. I think it goes back to the old days when in church everyone stood and there was just a seat around the edge and the weak went to the wall. So if you've had a hard day standing up, you've been working as a cashier somewhere and there's a seat near you or there's a person with a comfortable-looking lap, just go and get there. I'm not going to speak for any more than an hour and a half, was it, Craig? Sorry, but not really. That's right. Now, folks, heaps good. I didn't realise that was the South Australian phrase. It belongs to you. If you look up Wikipedia, which is the source of all true and objective and well-based knowledge, you type in Wikipedia to that. You type in Wikipedia, heaps good. It's all about South Australia. And you type it into the Urban Dictionary, and it's all about South Australia. And if I can quote Tigger, who's another great scholar, it's like his word splendiferous. It means that things are not just moderately good, but they are excellently good. And when it comes to produce, even arrogant, insular Sydney-siders hear about Adelaide, with the Barossa Valley and the Southern Valleys there, the McLaren Valley and others. And I like fishing. I get them occasionally. But everyone's heard of the great whiting you have here. They're all going to hear about the great capers you have here. Adelaide is famous for food, so to have a thing about heaps good for Adelaide is an obvious and a wise thing to do. But I didn't hear about the heaps good till about a week ago. I went on holidays and came back, and when I saw the God said, it's heaps good, I finally twigged, because I needed a holiday, obviously, because I hadn't worked it out till after the holiday, that's, of course, a reference to not Adelaide directly or focused, but it's a comment from the last verse of the first chapter of the Bible, where one of the things you might know in that description of the creation, when God makes everything, one of the things that is unique, and a lot of Westerners who think they're educated are actually appallingly uneducated sometimes, but we're confident, particularly in Sydney, uneducated but confident, that's us. Or as one of my friends says, profoundly superficial. But one of the things that I've discovered in the last 150 years through archaeology, which has been such a wonderful find, has been lots of religious literature from the ancient world around which the Jews and Israel were, and a number of creation stories. And when they were first discovered, there was a lot of excitement in the 19th century about some of the little parallels, and there were some little parallels in the way the stories are told. But now, scholars really note the enormous difference, and one of the differences is this heaps good thing. That almost all the great cultures, and many of them much more impressive cultures than Israel, much, much more impressive, Babylon and these other places, the world that we inhabited in these stories was actually the body of an evil goddess who had been killed by your local champion. If you're in Babylon, it was Marduk. If you're in Canaan, it was Baal. That there'd been a fight between the gods who were hard to get on with. And this female goddess, who sometimes is a dragon, it gets killed by the good guy, cut through the belly, turned inside out, and that's the world in which you live. So the world in which you find yourself living is the dead body of an evil goddess. Now, it's on that background you might pick up some of the difference that in Genesis 1, God makes the stars, and God said it was good. God makes the seas, and God said it was good. God makes the plants, and God said it was good. And when he finally makes the animals, the animal kingdom on the earth, and humans as well on the same day, and it draws attention to male and female, he created them. When it's all finished, he stands back and says, it was heaps good, as the Hebrew says. It was very good. And that has had an enormous influence on cultures that have been influenced by the Bible, that fundamentally the world in which we live, though it's broken and in terrible pain, as the Bible knows often more really than we do, is that it's fundamentally a good world we live in. It's full of good things. Humans are both wonderfully good as well as corrupt. And I wrote a letter to the Sydney Morning Herald a little while ago that got published, but by the time it got edited, it made even less sense than when I wrote it, arguing for the goodness of humankind. Because there's a tendency nowadays with the environmental problems and that to keep saying what nasty pieces of work humans are. And that's true, but we are also wonderfully good. And the food thing, actually I was chatting with a friend of mine I've known since my first day in primary school, 1843. And Rob rang me today, we go paddling together a bit still, and he, again, like most Sydney-siders, and I've told him this, thinks he knows about Christianity but wouldn't know it if he fell over it, but is into Buddhism, as most trendies are in Sydney. And he was shocked to hear that I was going to be at something which had good food and wine. I said, Rob, what's so shocking about that? I said, because the Bible's view, crystal clear from the beginning to the end, is that all the world is good. God, it says in Genesis chapter 2 that about this, a passing comment about the trees, that they were good to the eye and good to eat. That God makes a beautiful world. It's functional, it's beautiful, it's magnificent. And again the Bible celebrates food and wine to make the heart of man glad. Now, this is not a time for a comparative studies in religion, but I think I know enough about Islam to say that you'll find nothing in the Quran celebrating wine, that's for sure, and not a great deal celebrating food, in fact, nothing. And if you take the Buddha seriously, you might know the Buddha, the real one, not the silly westernized form. His key sermon, arguably, is the Sermon of the Fires, which T.S. Eliot says is like the Sermon on the Mount in its significance. The whole thing is warning against the dangers of the five senses, the dangers of taste, the dangers of smell. Do not get into it. I'm not saying he's right or wrong, but I'm saying that's not the view of the Bible. The Bible's view is that the world is great. Taste is good. Wine is a gift from God. Oil to make the face of humans shine. Food to nourish us, but much more. God could have, imagine, he could have done this, what I'm about to suggest to you, and none of us would have complained because we'd have been none the wiser. God could have made one vegetable. I often think of the zucchini. I remember my mum, and she's still alive, but I remember she was always a sort of an experimenter in the kitchen, and she brought home zucchinis one day back in the early 70s, I think. Cooked them to death, as you did. But, you know, it was still full marks for trying. But imagine God could have created the zucchini, which had every single nourishment you needed to live. Enough protein, enough vitamins, all that sort of stuff. Enough roughage. Say, wake up in the morning, what's on for breakfast, Dad? We're modern liberated people in Sydney. Zucchinis with zucchini milk. What's on for lunch, Mum? Boiled zucchinis. What's on for Christmas dinner? A really big zucchini. And we would never have complained. We would have just got all our nourishment, and it would do what it had to do. It would do the function. But God, and I don't have time here to argue for the existence of God, but I would be delighted to do that. But the God who made everything, even if you don't know much about him, is the God from whom all this stuff comes. And he chose to make the getting of your nourishment one of the high pleasures of life. That says something about God. It says something about God we often don't even notice. Most Australians and many atheists believe in God. But we often never stop to think, you know, you mean the wine that I enjoy, the food that I enjoy comes from God? Well, of course it does. Look closely, stand back, look at the whole process. It's got God's finger marks all over it. Which is why the prayer that some people, it's the only prayer they pray, is a very good prayer to pray, which is to say grace before a meal. Because in the end, one of the things that the Bible actually mentions, this might surprise you, one of the sins, if I can swear at you briefly, but we're adults mostly here, I think. If I can use that terrible swear word, sin, with you, one of the sins that Jesus and the Bible thinks is the most serious amongst humans is thanklessness. That we take and take and take and enjoy and enjoy and enjoy and never get on the phone and say thanks. Like some disgraceful, spoiled brat at university whose mum and dad are working long hours, putting money into their account so they can live well, and they never bother to say thanks. Thanklessness. And you want to just check yourself for that particular disease. One of the things I envy about America is, and there aren't many things, they don't play well, they actually do have 2 gold medals in rugby union. Did you know that? There's only been 4 gold medals, and America's got 2 of them. That was 1928 and some other weird period. long time ago. But I do envy America's Thanksgiving Day. Don't you reckon that's a great holiday? And whether you're Christian, which is where it came from, or just an ordinary American who doesn't believe in God, Americans apparently often get together on Thanksgiving Day and just go around and say, what am I thankful for? I heard an American, Australian comedian, I've been thinking all day, what was his name? I cannot remember. But I remember where I was when I heard him in this interview. He said, we live in a culture in Australia, and he loved Australia. He said, we live in a culture where we've got so much more than most people have ever had in history. We're completely unaware of it. We're deeply aware of what we don't have that we want. And that was the last phrase that got me. He said, and for whom gratitude is an unknown virtue. Now, of course, these are generalizations, but there's a truth in it, isn't there? The food that we've enjoyed today reminds us of the fact that we receive these gifts from God, whether we love God or hate God or pretend he isn't there or whatever. God just keeps these gifts. It's so beautiful. The few basic senses on the tongue that can pick up four, now they think five different sorts of flavours, and the pain thing, which is what's in chilies. When I did some study on taste some years ago and discovered that the way that chili works is actually a pain response. My youngest daughter who lives with me said, I always thought it was a stupid thing to eat chilies. But, you know, the very few sorts of flavours that the tongue can pick up, and yet the breathtaking, even the food and wine we've had today. I go home, I'm happy I've got my $70 worth, however much I paid for tonight. You know, it's been completely worth it. But it's like that with colours, isn't it? What is it, three or four, depending on who you listen to, primary colours? And the world is so beautiful. Music, 12 notes, I think, roughly, 12 tones. And I've recently had the pleasure of hearing the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra play Beethoven's 8th Symphony. Oh, man. It's just gorgeous what humans do as they're called to do, as they co-create with God in food. He gives a gift. It shows his kindness. And the response has to be, even if we don't know hardly anything about God, gratitude. Be ashamed to be like those spoilt brats who never stop to ring home and say thanks. Although, it's not seen like that, is it? I read an article in the Sydney Morning Herald, that great bastion of objective truth. And it's my paper, but it's a funny old paper. But there was an article, and it made this comment. One of our senior journalists, a very good journalist, and he said this. The early Christians, all the disciples of Jesus, were ascetics. You know, so an ascetic is someone who doesn't have much food, doesn't, you know, sleeps in freezing cold water and is constantly bashing the body to you know, don't drink wine, don't enjoy things. Of course, at that point, utterly, totally confusing Christianity with Buddhism. Because there is no doubt that the Buddha was an ascetic. And all the earliest and all true disciples of the Buddha will be ascetics in some form or other. Of course, that is exactly the opposite of Christianity. In fact, you'll find in one of the early letters in 1 Timothy 4 that it says people who forbid marriage, which is the Bible's understanding of where sexual pleasure should be enjoyed to the maximum, people who forbid marriage and outlaw certain foods, it describes that as the doctrine of demons. You might know much about the Bible, but that's not a complimentary way to speak. But Christianity is just not ascetic. Now, parts of the church might get infected with that. The church is always being infected with things. I'm always getting infected with wacky ideas and bad ways of behaving. That's for human life. But that's just... Jesus was accused by his enemies who ended up putting him to death of being a drunkard and a glutton. Now, no one who's an ascetic, you know, a denier of food and drinking and bodily pleasure, is ever going to be accused of being a drunkard or an ascetic. Read through, and I think as you go, you might have a chance to get a gospel of, say, just Luke's gospel's one, which I'm going to mention in a second. Jesus is forever having meals with people. Meals with rich people, meals with successful, high-ranking people, meals with prostitutes, meals with criminals, meals with all sorts of people. He's forever eating and drinking. And as was mentioned, the first miracle that John records, and there's no doubt at all that John's an eyewitness. You'll still hear on things like the Discovery Channel and other things like that, then John's gospel wasn't written until about 260 AD, which is the very best of 17th century thought, but somehow or other it keeps getting replicated on our televisions. There's no doubt at all, I'm happy to chat with you after. John's an eyewitness, without it, as he says. Mark's already been written, the other just that tell the story chronologically. He tells you he's picking out some of the key parts of Jesus' life. The very first miracle, as you mentioned, as was mentioned, I think David mentioned it, was this. Jesus makes at a wedding. It's interesting, the first impressive thing you see him do is not in the temple where you expect him, or not even in the beauty of the wilderness where we might expect him. It's at a wedding, which in those days was the big celebratory event of the ordinary peasant. It normally went for about a week. And if you were the groom, your job was to put wine aside and money aside for a long time. And if you ran out of wine, you could be sued. We've actually got evidence from the first century of Jewish families that were sued by the bride's family because they ran out of wine. It's a disgraceful thing. And that's about the only time they drank wine. I guess it was like us drinking French champagne. I guess the only sort you're allowed to have now, isn't it? You can't have Aussie champagne anymore. But, you know, It was that which you had when you had a high celebration. They run out of wine. And Jesus makes, with no flurry of activity and no one really knows what's going on, he just does it on the sly, he makes 180 gallons of, I've always thought it was Shiraz, of Shiraz. That's 2,000 standard glasses, roughly. That's a tad of wine. And as was rightly said, it was not Sanitarium dark red grape juice. Good and all as that is. And you may remember that the steward who you sort of employed to look after the event so the groom and everyone else could enjoy the week's festivities, you know, eat, drink, dance, sleep, eat, drink. That's what they did for seven. That's what the people of God did. They celebrated sexuality and love, etc. The steward tastes this wine that's coming out towards the end. He goes up to the groom and says, "What are you, some sort of an idiot?" This is like an Australianised translation. It's a bit like heaps good. Very good. "What are you, some sort of an idiot?" He said, "Everyone knows you bring the best wine out first, and when people have had a bit to drink, then you bring out shadow cardboard." But he said, "What have you done?" He said, you've kept the very best wine till the end." So Jesus makes 2,000 glasses, and often the Jews drank it watered down half and half, so that's 4,000. 2,000 standard glasses of beautiful Shiraz. That's his first miracle. The notion of thinking that Christianity has got some problem with the beautiful, enjoyable, good things of the creation is just so far from the facts. Jesus, and the picture of it is Jesus says, "I've come to bring life." Not, you know what, I spent about 3 months of my life having been convinced that Christianity was true, reluctantly, looked at the evidence at the resurrection and the New Testament and realized that the myths were not in the New Testament. The myths were the ones I was brought up with about the New Testament when I finally looked at the evidence. But I spent about 3 months knowing it was true, but really, I did not want to become a Christian because I really thought it was like a death sentence. It's like I've been living a full technicolor life. If I follow Jesus, it's going to become, it's not even going to black and white, it's going to become a horrible radio that keeps having static. And I thought it was that it would be the diminishment of life. Now, just think about that. That's a very common view. What does that view say about God? Unconsciously, the view that says best to avoid God if you can actually says that God is evil. God is wicked. God wants to rip you off. And he makes this world full of pleasures. But he's got some weird hang-up. That's rubbish. We've got hang-ups. We're like addicts who've learned bad ways of living, and at times God's ways seem really weird still. But Jesus, when he turns the water into wine, it's a picture of what he longs to do. And all the way through the Bible, eating food together with loved ones and friends, and even eating a meal with God, is what the Bible thinks that life is all about. So in Luke 14, Jesus tells one of the many, many stories he tells about a guy throwing a party. It's a great thing to read the Gospels, particularly once you become an adult, and see what Jesus actually says. And in Luke 14, I'm not going to read you the whole story because we've only got a few more seconds to go, where Jesus says this: "A certain man was throwing a mega banquet," it's literally a huge banquet, "and he sends out invitations to people. And the story is about how people respond to the invitations and the weird way in which..." So this man throws a mega banquet. Jesus has other stories. He talks about people throwing wedding banquets. You might know that the most common picture of heaven the Bible has, again and again and again, is of a banquet. If you're hoping to be going floating on clouds, as far as I can tell in the Bible, it ain't going to happen. Who knows what you can do in heaven, but that's just not a picture it has. There is one reference to harps being played in the Bible. I think it's actually angels, and harps are normally part of a whole orchestra. But the picture is, again and again, that the Bible, that Jesus chooses, that, you know what it's like to become a Christian? It's like to come to the first course of a banquet and the next courses are going to endure forever. And the question is, not only that God has been generous in giving us the gifts of physical creation in all different sorts, we haven't even touched on some of them, but his other generosity is he invites you to come to his place. It's not just that he gives stuff which actually costs him nothing, although he does a lot of thinking to make it pleasurable, but he actually wants you to be part of his life. He wants to bless you. I mean, I've got some wonderful friends. I'm making some good friends here in Adelaide. You've been very kind to me. But this might sound silly, but imagine if it was possible to become friends with the God who made, invented capers. Right? Mangoes. Chilies. Right? And the whole universe. And that's actually what you're saying. God is saying, you want to come to my house. Come into friendship with me. And the weird thing in the story is everyone starts to make excuses. Right? And in the end, a terrible lot of people miss out on the greatest gift of all that God was wanting to bring. And the Bible does struggle trying to tell us what heaven's going to be like. Let me just suggest something to you. Imagine you had one of those fish, I think it is in that wonderful book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Imagine if we had a fish that you could hold to a pregnant woman's belly and you could speak into the fish and it could translate it into a language the baby in the womb could understand. You got the picture? Baby, almost full term. It's in the womb. It's ready to go. You can talk to it. Now, here's your quest. Describe to that baby what it's like to eat a mango. Oh, it can understand English too, by the way. Describe to that baby what it's like to eat a mango. Because how do we describe the wines? Well, it's got a touch of freshly cut pear, which isn't very helpful if you've never eaten pear, is it? Or you've only got them out of a can. Or pink grapefruit, I think, was one of the other things. See, we always compare things like, it's like that. So how do you describe a mango to someone who's never eaten one? Well, you say it's kind of like a peach, but sweeter and juicier and messier. And describe it to the baby. Now, here's the thing. The baby's got all the machinery to taste mango, right? And in a couple of years, God willing, it will enjoy mango. It's real. The mango's real, the baby's real. What's the problem? Baby's lack of experience. All it's tasted so far is sort of salty amniotic fluid. Not too good. A bit like rice for 5 days, only longer. But you see, this is the problem that God has when he wants to describe to you what's on the other side of death. Life's great, but it's short. And when Jesus wants to describe both heaven and hell, he struggles because they're both real, according to Jesus, because if you know more than Jesus, you can forget about both. But if you think he's got some sort of qualifications, you can only describe by saying it's like something. Because how do you describe a mango? So I'm saying we're in exactly the situation of the baby with the mango. There's a real heaven that God is inviting people to, and there's a real hell that people go if they choose not to go to heaven. The way he describes it is things like this. It's like a banquet. And it describes it with the aged wines and the finest of breads and the richest of meats. And you know what the streets are made of? We often hear these phrases, we haven't thought it. They're made of pure gold, gold that's so pure it's almost see-through. Now, I held in my hand the other day a 5-ounce block of gold. I suddenly understood why people fell in love with that stuff. It feels like an iPhone. It's got a good feeling. Just so you think, I've just got a Galaxy, you know, phone. So, but iPhones have got a good feel in the hand. The gold felt good in my hand. It looked beautiful, and it was worth $8,000. It used to be worth $9,500. Suddenly, it's worth $8,000 now. I was a bit nervous when I went out the street because there were some young men there who looked a bit tough. They weren't tough there on the North Shore of Sydney. No one's tough on the North Shore of Sydney. But I was nervous because I think if they knew I had, tiny little thing here. When God says, in the city that I'm taking you to, this great banquet is the other great picture, the streets are paved with gold. What do we pave streets with? Well, what did they pave streets with back in the time when the Bible was written? Dirt and rocks. It's been a long time since we've had a robbery in Sydney where a truck carrying dirt and rocks was held up, right? They're not hard to get. They're not highly valued. What the Bible's saying is this is, you know the stuff we make the streets from? You hardly notice it. Well, the gold, that which is most precious and terribly beautiful, which gold is, make the streets of it. See, he's running comparisons. Because God is very generous. You see it in the beauty of just getting nourishment, right? And you see it even more in the invitation that he sends to us. And the question is whether or not we've RSVP'd to the invitation. Now, you want to, if you've never read a Gospel of Luke, particularly since you became an adult, do yourself a favour. You may have met wacky Christians. You may have been hurt by Christians. But it'd be a shame to miss the main game because of some idiot. It's a bit like someone who says, you know, I'm never going to Italy. I don't want to see Tuscany in the spring. Why not? Well, I had a bad pizza once. You know, I got one from Pizza Hut and it made me say, that's Italian. Well, you know, yeah, I can see the link. But it's like someone said, why this rotten? I met this Christian once when I was 12. Get a life. Have a look at the main game. Have a look at Luke as an adult. When I did that as a young adult, 18, I was shocked what was in there. I thought I knew what was in the Bible. I didn't have the faintest clue. But Jesus comes and says, I want to invite you into my family. That cost him. That cost him big time. And the way that we remember how much it cost him is in a tiny meal Christians have together. There's this thing about food, about blood being shed and bread being eaten. So I'm going to shut up in about 30 seconds. Just want you to ponder these two things as we enjoy the rest of the good stuff we're going to enjoy. If it's half as good as what we've had so far, I'm looking forward to it. See whether or not you've got into the gratitude thing. You mightn't know God very much, but you know in amongst the misery that humans have brought to your life as well, you've enjoyed a lot of good things. You've enjoyed a lot of good drinks of cold water. You've enjoyed some good Coopers, Great Adelaide Drop. You've enjoyed good wine. You've enjoyed all sorts of things. Not to be one of the people who is thankless. It takes and takes and takes and takes and takes and takes. That's a serious breakdown in your relationship with the God who's the source of the giving. And see how you're going with the RSVP. You are invited into friendship. It's probably better to say, no, rack off, you're a dull bore, than just not to RSVP at all. Just pretend it hasn't happened. So there'd be two things you might like to think about. Thanking God, saying thanks for food, and inquiring about this weird invitation to this place where the streets are paved with gold, or even better. Thank you for your patience in listening, and those who've stood, congratulations. You can sit on my lap later on when I sit down here. Thank you. Let's move on.